I thank you for the very indulgent introduction, and I may need a little indulgence. Those of you who were at my talk at Waterloo last week will have recognized that as a colloquium that I've given many times and is in a high state of preparation. I think you will recognize this as a colloquium that I'm giving for the first time, and it isn't really finished yet. So I hope I'm not surprised by anything that appears on the slides, but we'll see. There are some gaps that I'll try and fill in. It's switched on here. It's working. Can you hear me? Oh, okay. How about now? Is that better? Okay. So I was just apologizing that this talk isn't quite finished. So, but there's a blackboard. Let's see how well I can do. Okay. So what I'd like to talk about is a theory associated with the physics at the Large Hadron Collider. And I'm sure you've had a lot of talks in this room about the Large Hadron Collider, how it's going to discover the Higgs boson, supersymmetry, extra dimensions, all kinds of new particles that theorists have been dreaming about, well, more or less as long as I've been in physics. And it is indeed a very exciting prospect. There's only one problem, which is that when you actually look, ooh, it's very reverberant. Is that okay now? When you actually look at events that come from the LHC, to a first approximation, all you see is QCD. First of all, the proton-proton total cross-section itself has a magnitude of 100 millibarns. The typical cross-sections that you're interested in for new particle production are picobarns. There's a gap of 11 orders of magnitude between those numbers. And somehow you have to fish down through all the levels of what is going on in QCD to find new physics. So it's interesting to think about all these exotic processes, but one of the things you really have to do is to understand QCD better in order to try and understand these kinds of backgrounds. And actually, at that level, QCD itself becomes really a fascinating subject with a lot of subtlety and intrigue. And certainly, it's worth a colloquium, so let me try and give that one. So just to put in perspective what I just said, here are some estimates of the sizes of important cross-sections at the LHC. The total cross-section of 100 millibarns. The cross-section for production of very energetic two-jet events is of order a microbarn. A microbarn is such a large cross-section that at the LHC design parameters, one can't even trigger on all those events and write them on tape. Then you go down another two orders of magnitude to come to the rate for lepton and neutrino production. So already you're making hard leptons and missing energy. Another order of magnitude, you're making dileptons. Another less than an order of magnitude, you're making top quarks. And finally, many, many orders of magnitude below are the new particles that we hope to find. Here's a very typical LHC event recorded by the ATLAS experiment. You see two very clear jets in this event. Over on the left, you see what's called the Lego plot visualization of this event. This is a balanced two-jet event, QQ bar scattering from one another at large angles, producing two jets of particles going in opposite directions. It's clear that this event is very complex, and I think it's not so hard for you to imagine that it's easy to have things go wrong or add extra things to this event in such a way that it would look like a very exotic event associated with new particle production. Here are a couple more of these, just so you get the idea. This is a two-jet event almost fluctuating to a three-jet event. Here's a six-jet event that was observed in ATLAS. Six jets may sound like a lot, but the remark about this event is that it's perfectly within our understanding. The little inset histogram there is the QCD prediction for the cross-sections for various numbers of jets. This event represents that last data point in the corner, and you'll see that the probability of finding that event is in perfect accord with QCD. So one of the problems is that we're going to have to persuade ourselves that events that look like this are or are not things that can come directly out of the standard model. So the dominant QCD events are too jet-like, and they don't have unbalanced transverse momentum. So the control of the background from those events has to do mainly with building a detector with no large gaps and a very uniform calibration. Here's just some data on missing energy calibration from the very early days of ATLAS. This is actually April of last year. And you see that the missing energy resolution is very close to the square root of the total transverse energy. That would be the expectation for a kind of perfect detector that does energy measurement by sampling the way ATLAS does. And so, you know, so far so good. We're going to be able to understand this part of it. It seems clear. But processes with W, Z, and T are more complicated. As I said, already at the nanobarn level of cross-section, they're making leptons and missing energy. And when you start adding gluons, you start getting processes of the kind that I've drawn up here. And this is now a definitely scary thing. We need to estimate these backgrounds, and we need to subtract them from any new physics signals. Just to remind you, even at the Tevatron, W, Z, and T are the dominant backgrounds to most of the things that you want to observe. Here's an old slide from the D0 experiment, which is a search for supersymmetry in acolinear dijets. So it's plotted as a function of the missing energy, and a supersymmetry signal that's excluded is given by the hatched region there. But even to make that plot, you have to think about dijet events with unbalanced momentum that come from QCD. And if you look at what's not on that plot, that's shown in this plot. So what you have are back-to-back jets, which might not, if these jets are not back-to-back, or if they're not balanced in momentum, then they would show up on that plot. Now here are all the jets, and you see there's a cut that's made at an angle in the transverse direction of 40 degrees. If you go inside that angle, a huge background arises, which are just back-to-back jets that are just mismeasured. So in principle, one would like to understand all aspects of this distribution from a more fundamental theory. Here's just another, I'll show you just one more of these. This is a plot from the D0 Higgs search. And as you see, the dominant backgrounds here are top, Z, W, plus gluons, plus BB bar of various kinds. The Higgs signal are those little red, you see the red histogram down there. And that's the Higgs signal multiplied by a factor of 10. So in order to see it, you need a very accurate accounting for everything else that's colored in this diagram. For supersymmetry, we don't know, at the LHC, we don't know really what the prospects are, but here are two extreme examples from some early simulation paper by Yetkin and Spiropoulou. This shows the case for a model with a gluino of 600 GeV. Where you see that the SUSY signals are just hugely larger than an appropriately cut set of standard model backgrounds. But if SUSY is heavier, then that SUSY signal is buried in the standard model backgrounds. And one really needs to understand where those backgrounds are precisely in order to say that there is or is not a signal, much less to figure out what that signal is telling us. Okay, maybe we should go ahead now and begin the question of what we can do about this in terms of trying to provide more accurate computation of QCD amplitudes. And for this, I'd like to discuss the problem in four stages. First of all, the computation of tree amplitudes. Secondly, the computation of loop amplitudes. Secondly, something called parton showers. And finally, a discussion of something called jet substructure. Tree amplitudes are easy. You draw some Feynman diagrams on the blackboard. For example, a quark and a gluon turning into a quark that goes out, maybe a W boson, which is emitted and decays to a lepton and a neutrino. But remember, this can create many gluons on the way out and eventually turn into what I call the stampede of gluons in the title of this talk. For this final state, there are maybe 100 Feynman diagrams that would contribute to that final state. No individual one is gauge invariant. We have to compute them all. So how do you do that? Well, it turns out that since the beginning of the 80s, there have been some nice methods that are proposed, which are a dramatic improvement for diagrams like that on the methods of Feynman diagrams evaluation that you could, for example, learn by reading my book. And something that helps very much is to notice that essentially all the particles that are involved here are massless, so we can take advantage of the special properties of light-like momentum vectors. So let me just introduce a notation for that. Let me use brackets, angle brackets and square brackets, to denote the spinners of light-like momenta. It turns out that the product of spinners, the spinner product, is a very useful object. And this gives rise to a technology that Behrens and Wu started developing in the early 80s. If you take that, for example, U bar L U R, let me write that as the angle bracket 1, 2. If I square that, it turns out that that's equal to the Lorentz dot product. So the angle brackets are the square roots of Lorentz dot product, in just the way that the Dirac equation is the square root of the Klein-Gordon equation. The angle brackets obey some very simple identities, which I've written here. And then one can just begin working with those objects instead of, for example, squaring and tracing or something like that to evaluate Feynman diagrams. Here's a very simple example, but it shows you what the power is. Here's a trivial Feynman diagram evaluated at the very beginning of my book. It takes maybe 3 or 4 pages to do it by the usual way. Here you can do it in essentially one line. You write down the expression in terms of these brackets. You use the Fiertz identity, and immediately you arrive at that expression at the beginning of the second line, which actually you could directly evaluate on a computer, and you've got the answer. However, there's something which is also cute to do, which is multiply by 1 in the way that I've described. 4331 contains 3/, the Dirac matrix multiplied by the momentum 3. So you can use momentum conservation to turn that into 4221 and cancel the factor of 42 in the numerator. Once you've done that, it's an expression only in terms of angle brackets, which is a very cool thing. Then we can easily square it using the fact that those brackets are the square roots of Lorentz vector products, and you arrive at the identity on the last line. And those of you who are students in my particle physics course will immediately recognize this as the correct answer. So as I said, if you don't want to do this extra stuff that I've done, you could arrive at that answer on the second line, essentially in one line after writing the Feynman diagram. So needless to say, for diagrams like this, you have to work a little harder. But these methods basically give you access to very easy techniques to speed up calculation. OK. Now, you can also add photons. It turns out there are useful representations of the photon vectors, which are also in the spinner product language. I think I won't explain this in detail, except just to say the methods are available to include gluons as well as fermions. And then in QCD, there's one more trick, which is immensely useful, which is to organize the color in a convenient way. So let me organize the color the way I would do it in string theory by writing each external gluon as something with a color and an anti-color end, with a kind of string diagram laid out in the middle. Then I can decompose the gluon amplitude into color structures and color-ordered amplitudes. And those, it turns out, have much simpler expressions than the complete diagrams. So putting all these methods together, you get a fairly automatic method of calculation that applies to very high orders. Well, people did that in the 80s, and very striking results were obtained, which I'll just say on the next slide. So Park and Taylor, in the mid-80s, attacked this problem very systematically, trying to evaluate gluon amplitudes of very high order. And they discovered some amazing things. If you look at the color-ordered amplitude, and so a typical seven-particle color-ordered amplitude is shown in the diagram that I've drawn here, you just for convenience, I'll label all the helicities of particles so that they're all outgoing. That gives the simplest description because it's completely symmetric among all the particles. You discover that if all the helicities are the same, let's say all plus, the amplitude just vanishes. There are 100 Feynman diagrams. You add them all up. The answer is zero. There's a simpler calculation that's on the problem set in my course this week. I hope my students have understood that. Similarly, if there's only one minus sign and all the rest plus, then the amplitudes are zero. And those things are true to all orders in perturbation theory for tree diagrams. Now, even more amazing, let's go to the next level, where you have two minus signs and all the rest plus. Then, in fact, you add up all the Feynman diagrams, and you get an answer which is incredibly simple, which I've written here. And very surprisingly, that answer is given only in terms of angle brackets and involves no square brackets. So these are the amplitudes which are called maximum helicity violating, because they have the maximum number of plus amplitudes and the minimum number of minus amplitudes. And Park and Taylor discovered this amazing formula, which is actually true for the tree diagrams of QCD, no matter how many gluons you want to stick on the external lens. Okay. Now, and maybe I should say, for diagrams with fermions, for diagrams even with W bosons, there are similar formulae for particular helicity amplitudes. So actually, at this point, we've made a lot of progress. We can't compute all the amplitudes in the theory yet. We'll get there in a moment. But for some amplitudes, the answers are just trivial. We can just write them down and evaluate them immediately. Now, the next thing I should say is that there are some connections here to some really deep ideas. First of all, if we generalize from Young-Mills theory to supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, you can prove that those amplitudes vanish using the supersymmetric Ward identities. Very roughly, if I have a gluon coming out of a diagram with positive helicity, that's related by supersymmetry to a gluino coming out of the diagram with positive helicity. But the gluino eventually has to come out the other end with negative helicity by helicity conservation. So the gluino emerging from that end has to have negative helicity. Now, if I have all plus amplitudes, this guy here does not have a Suzy partner, and so necessarily it vanishes. If you study the Suzy Ward identities a little more carefully, you can show that even this amplitude with all pluses vanishes. Essentially, you can relate this to one more gluino coming through the diagram with the Suzy Ward identities. And so Suzy actually implies, not only in the tree diagrams, but to all orders in perturbation theory, that the first non-zero amplitude is the maximum helicity violating amplitude with two minuses and all the rest pluses. The other thing you can notice, now, ordinary Young-Mills theory, of course, is not a supersymmetric theory. But it's pretty good. It's the orbifold of a supersymmetric theory. And many of you know, I hope all of you know, that if you take a theory with a high symmetry and you mod out by that symmetry, so the orbifold construction, then the tree amplitudes of the particles that are left are just exactly the same as in the theory with the high symmetry. It's just that some diagrams are missing. At the loop level, you have to be a little more clever. We'll get to that in a moment. The other thing about this amplitude is that it very suggestively depends only on the angle brackets and not on the square brackets. So in the early part of this decade, Witten picked up on this. He thought about spinner variables representing light-like vectors is what you do in the twister construction. So he thought of that expression as an expression in twister space. And very nicely, the expression in twister space is completely holomorphic. The angle brackets are the complex conjugates of the square brackets, but we've got only one in that expression and not the other. So in fact, you can write down some kind of string theory in twister space which generates these MHV amplitudes as its elementary amplitudes, as its essentially the Feynman rules of that theory. And Freddie and Peter Svercek and other people worked with Witten to really develop this technique along a certain line. You guys have probably heard Freddie and Nimar Kani-Hamed talk about that whole theoretical direction, which goes off into Grassmannians, twisters, et cetera, et cetera. I'm now going to take a left turn, but I'd like to talk about one thing that Freddie did, which is incredibly important to this more practical stuff. So the question then arises, can I take all the other amplitudes, for example, ones with 3 minus signs or 4 minus signs, and compute them in terms of the MHV amplitudes as the basic building blocks? And so Freddie and Ruth Brito and Bo Feng showed how to do that using a very general and beautiful construction. The idea, basically, is to take an amplitude and try and cut it into 2 pieces, and then build it up out of these pieces. So if I think about 2 particle to 2 particle amplitudes, there's always at least 2 minus, there are never more than 2 minus signs or 2 plus signs in those amplitudes. So I know them all from the MHV formula. For 5 particle amplitudes, it's also true. The worst I can have is 3 of one and 2 of the other without the amplitude vanishing. So if somehow I could take a 17 particle amplitude and break it down to 5 particle amplitudes, I'd be done. Then I can just put in the input from the MHV formula and we're all set. The problem with that is that when you take a cut of a Feynman diagram, typically you end up with a line here which is off shell. And that's a disaster because the simplicity of these amplitudes has to do with the fact that these are on shell gauge invariant amplitudes. If you go to a gauge theory, as soon as you take a line off shell, things get incredibly more complicated, they're gauge dependent. All kinds of extra terms arise. And people who'd been in the field a long time knew that this was some kind of essential barrier against a unitarity-based construction like that. But of course, Freddie and his colleagues hadn't been in the field a long time, so they just invented a way to do it. And the very cool way is to think about shifting the amplitude by going to complex momenta, that is, taking one line and shifting the square bracket, but not the angle bracket, and taking another line and shifting the angle bracket, but not the square bracket. So then you get a function m of z, which depends on this complex variable z. It will, in general, be an analytic function of that variable. And we want to evaluate m of 0. So now, where are the poles of that amplitude? The poles occur exactly when there's a propagator here whose momentum depends on z. And the pole appears when q squared, it's a 1 over q squared, so the pole appears at q squared equals 0 when that momentum is on shell, of course on shell, but at a complex unphysical value. But who cares? If we compute the contour integral of m of z over z, we get the amplitude we want to compute plus some other poles plus the contour at infinity. It turns out that very often, and you can define the circumstances, the contour at infinity vanishes. M of z equals 0 is the amplitude we want to compute, and the poles are given by putting intermediate momenta on shell. And then you can just evaluate those from the gauge invariant expressions for the two tree diagrams and come to a formula like this, where the ingredients have exactly this structure. The intermediate line is evaluated at an unphysical complex momentum, and also complex momenta are injected. But the formulae are analytic, so you can evaluate them. And they always involve on-shell amplitude, so they're extremely simple. So now if you have a six-particle amplitude, you can break it down into a five and a three-particle amplitude and evaluate those from the MHV formulae. A seven-particle amplitude, similarly, 8, 9, 10, we're done. And so one then obtains a general recursive formula for computing any QCD amplitude, actually even for computing amplitudes of the kind here that involve Ws and even top quarks. It all applies in this formula. Maybe I should also say that there are other, even more heavy-duty recursion formula developed by other people, Berens and Hila, Mangano and Moretti, and other groups. So, and BCF also showed that this method that they used applies to more general theories. It applies to gravity, it applies to other non-renormalizable theories. It's really a very general computational method for tree amplitudes that we might need in the LHC era. Okay, well now we're doing pretty well. The tree diagrams are done. We can compute any tree diagram of arbitrarily high order, implement this algorithm on a computer, have it churn away. In a millisecond or two, we've got a 10 gluon amplitude. So is that good enough? Well, no. So now we come to the next problem, that once you have the tree amplitudes, there's still a lot of ambiguity and a lot of error with respect to the final answer, the exact answer in QCD. There are some ways of understanding that. The first way of understanding it is just to think of the following question. In QCD, we have an asymptotically free theory. The coupling constant runs. And the coupling constant runs to with a formula like that, which is the solution of the renormalization group equation. Now, it depends on some alpha of Q. So the question is, if I'm interested in a certain reaction, for example, two gluons coming and producing three gluons, at what momentum Q am I supposed to evaluate alpha? Is it the transverse momentum of the gluon? Is it S, T, some sub-energy? It's unclear. It's clear what the order of magnitude is, maybe, but your guesses for where explicitly to evaluate Q could vary by a factor of 2, which will cause this factor of alpha S to vary by 10%. If you have 3 gluon radiation, it's actually alpha S cubed, and so that error has gone up to 30%. If you want to evaluate a diagram like that, you're in trouble. And so in order to do that, where does the uncertainty come from? This uncertainty would be compensated if we knew exactly at what point to refer the running coupling constant. That is made precise by doing a calculation of one higher order. And so very often people use the method on this slide to estimate the accuracy of the next higher order correction that you haven't computed yet. Let's say by varying Q by a factor of 2 in either direction. And on the slides that I'll show you, the error bands are made up in that way. However, it turns out that this method is part of the uncertainty, but it's by no means all of it. And other very important effects can come in. Very famously, this is a large effect in the Drell-Yan process. That is to say, the process which is basically this process I've shown here. Most basically, a process where protons come in, a particle comes out of one, a quark, an antiquark comes out of the other, and you make a W boson, which you then observe in a lepton and neutrino final state. So in the next higher order in QCD, there are contributions where you exchange a gluon here, where you radiate a gluon. There are also contributions of the type I've drawn here, where you have a quark-gluon collision, which then ends up with a radiated quark in the final state. Let me show you, because Drouillet has been analyzed pretty thoroughly, what the corrections look like and the errors that I've estimated in this way for leading order, next to leading order, which would be diagrams like this, and also even next to leading order, the two-loop corrections. So these are some calculations done by Anastasio et al. This is a relatively low energy for the Tevatron collider. You see the leading order estimate, and the error estimate that I gave here is that blue band. It actually doesn't depend on alpha S at all, so there are only some uncertainties from parton distributions. The next to leading order, when you actually calculate it, is enormously higher, about 50% higher than the leading order correction. And then the next to leading order is another small shift beyond that, please notice, outside the error band. So one has to do some work here. Very often one refers to this the size of the correction from QCD as something called a K factor. People who would like easy answers would like to say, well, you just multiply the K factor as a number, you multiply by something. But here, these guys plotted the K factor as a function of the, essentially the boost of the W with respect to the proton-proton center of mass frame. And they found it depends very substantially on that boost. So you need to know the correction both in the overall cross-section and as a function of the kinematics. Where does that factor come from? Well, it turns out that when you compute this diagram and you compare to your reference the processes with which you evaluate these parton distributions in the proton, essentially, you measure the proton distributions in the space-like region. You have the Drouillet process with the W in the time-like region. The analytic continuation introduces a factor of alpha times pi squared in the amplitude, and you get something of this form that I've written on this slide, 1 plus alpha s over pi, but then there's a coefficient which is pi squared times something. And that's a large number, 1.3 when you go around to the annihilation kinematics, and it can be even larger in other specific kinematic circumstances. So it's actually not at all atypical that these QCD corrections can boost the values of the amplitudes you can you compute by large factors like that. So here's the LHC, and again, you see this thing that I was describing. One very notorious example is actually one of the most important processes at the LHC, Higgs boson production. You can easily compute the cross-section for gluon-gluon fusion to Higgs boson production. It's basically, two gluons coming together, a virtual top quark loop, and the Higgs boson comes out like that. That's a, elementary calculation in quantum field theory. If you compute the radiative corrections to this cross-section, for example, from diagrams like this or diagrams like this, and you add them all up, it turns out to increase the cross-section by a factor of 2. Anastasio et al. And other people did the next to leading order correction. And that, it turns out, is another 20% higher. So here is actually another group, Harlander and Kilgore, the calculation of this cross-section. You see that the leading order effect is the black bands. Next to leading order is a factor of 2 higher, the green bands. And NNLO is the red bands. And, these cross-sections are so hard, you've got to hope it's converging. But we don't really know for sure, frankly. Okay. Maybe I should also say that these corrections are kinematics dependent. So, I'm sorry? To be asymptotic? Oh. Oh, yeah, but everything in quantum field theory is an asymptotic series, right? The series for G minus 2 is an asymptotic series, but it converges fantastically. But here, unfortunately, you're at the place where the series is already diverging at the second term, and it's an asymptotic series, so you might really be in trouble. This curve just shows that those effects are different, depend on the kinematics. And so, in fact, one needs to include these effects paying attention to where you are kinematically, event by event. Now, if you want to compute these amplitudes, it's effort. For 2-to-2 processes, you can do it by hand. And that was already something that people did in the 80s. For 2-to-3 processes, it begins to become a large calculation. Thousands of Feynman diagrams, one-loop Feynman diagrams, with thousands or tens of thousands of terms per Feynman diagram. And it's a gauge theory. So basically, when you add up all the Feynman diagrams, the size of the answer is about the magnitude of an individual Feynman diagram. So when people started on 2-to-3 next to leading order calculations, this was around 1990, the results were like 20,000 line Fortran programs, which never then converged because of computational error. Nowadays, if you want to compute the radiative corrections to a process like this, for example, a diagram like that, it's even worse. Millions of terms in a diagram, thousands of diagrams. You really have to push beyond brute force Feynman diagram evaluation and figure out some new methods. And so let me just give you a quick route through methods that are proving effective today. So first of all, probably the systematic evaluation of loop diagrams always goes back to some very beautiful work done in the 70s by Passerino and Veltman. Veltman had just, of course, invented the renormalizable theory of weak interactions, and he wanted to test it to the one-loop level. And the standard model is a kind of complicated theory with lots of particles, so there are lots of diagrams to evaluate it, so one should do it systematically. So Passerino and Veltman had the insight that if you have any kind of an integral like that, let's say an integral with 7 particles coming out of it, and you evaluate the integral, that's only 6 particles, but whatever, and you evaluate the integral in 4 dimensions, there are only 4 linearly independent momenta that appear in the loop. So then you can simplify the expression by partial fractions. And you can always get it down to terms that have only 4 different momenta in the denominator and various complicated kinematic factors in the integral. And then, once you look at those integrals, you can evaluate the a pi, the coefficients for your diagram. And then you just have some table of integrals that you have to compute. And so Passerino and Veltman then systemized that table of integrals, and they computed a lot of them. Of course, if you're Veltman, there's the former graduate student who's very good at doing integrals named Gerard Tuft. And so Tuft helped them complete the catalog and essentially compute all of the integrals that you would need to compute one-loop diagrams. And this method was actually applied when people did the theory associated with precision electroweak measurements that were done at LEP and SLC. Now, one can really simplify this a lot if you're dealing with either massless particles or particles with a higher symmetry, like supersymmetry. And so in the 90s, this group of people whom I've listed there, Byrne, Dixon, Dunbar, and Kossauer, had a very nice insight, which is that if you go to n equals 4, so in general, then, we have our kind of complicated diagrams with lots of legs and lots of things in the integral. Then we can write that as some series with coefficients and things that are boxes, and then lower point integrals, let me write that as bn and triangles, and cn and bubbles, and maybe even dn and tadpoles. With massless particles, the tadpoles are absent, although when we get to things that involve Higgs and top, those have to be analyzed. Now, something very beautiful that happens is that in the supersymmetric theory, there are only boxes. The natural cancellations of the supersymmetric theory remove this line. And this group of people, Baron and collaborators, realized that in n=4 Young-Mills theory, there's a very limited set of master integrals that appear in this equation. So if you just take the unitarity cut of a diagram, you can figure out which integrals in the catalog appear. And then once you've done the integrals, they're done once and for all, you just need to evaluate the coefficients. So that gave a very efficient way of doing loop computations in n=4 super Young-Mills theory. That's not the real world, but actually it's pretty close to the real world. Because anyone who's computed Feynman diagrams with, let's say, a loop of gluons like that, knows that it's the spin 1 particles that are the really hard part. So if I now add some fermions and some scalars, I can make an n=4 supersymmetric amplitude. I now subtract fermions and their supersymmetric partners, and this is n=1 supersymmetric. And then we have to subtract all the scalars that we've added. And this is n=0 supersymmetric, but it only involves scalars, which are much easier to deal with in Feynman diagrams than vectors. So these we can do with some really slick techniques. And then it kind of gets harder as you go down the blackboard, but you're dealing with objects of lower and lower spin. So now, in a step in the work that I was talking about previously, Brito, Cacciazzo, and Feng had a very interesting observation about how to deal with these particles, these kinds of diagrams. Well, in those diagrams, there are 4 Ks. So why don't we just take our big diagram like this and put 4 lines on shell and look at the quadruple unitarity cut through that diagram. Then that structure can only come from some particular integral over here. And by doing the quadruple unitarity cut, we've identified it. In fact, we can then go backwards. We don't have to deal with the individual Feynman diagrams at all. We just look at structures like the one that I've shown up here, where you have some lines on shell, and then arbitrary tree amplitudes in the 4 corners. We can evaluate tree amplitudes for as many external legs as we like. I just showed you how to do that. And so then that product of 4 tree amplitudes becomes the coefficient of a known integral in the catalog here. And now we've evaluated loop amplitudes. Very slick. So now we're done with n=4. But now, and actually for any supersymmetric theory, but can we go beyond supersymmetric theories? So that involves trying to figure out what the coefficients are in these triangle and bubble terms. The triangles are associated with 3 particle cuts in the diagram. The problem is that the 3 particle cuts also get a contribution from here, but since we've evaluated this already, we can work it out. And then you can go kind of down the ladder. These people who are named on this slide, Asola, Papadopoulos, and Pitau, found a systematic algorithm to determine the B and C coefficients. And Ford found some incredibly nice tricks to simplify that procedure. In principle, in particular, again, by using unphysical complex momenta, you can make some asymptotic limits of those complex momenta, where, for example, when you're trying to figure out which is this and which is this, the triangles dominate in the asymptotic limit. No. See, in this In this calculation, for example, I'm just trying to calculate this diagram here. Right. So I introduce some fictitious gluinos, and I subtract them out again. And similarly for these fictitious bosons. So the end result is a calculation in QCD. I'm just using supersymmetry in an intermediate step to simplify the calculation. Similarly over here, if the world were supersymmetric, I could stop here. But since the world is not supersymmetric, you have to do a little extra work. And maybe I should also say there are some rational terms that have zero unitarity cut, which you have to determine. And you need some extra tricks to do those. Actually, Berger, Ford, and Barron and collaborators figured out a way to do those using a BCF recursion, similar to the way you can compute tree diagrams. Well, it doesn't matter whether they're supersymmetric particles or not. The method still works as long as the supersymmetric particles exist in theory, right? You just take a non-supersymmetric theory, you write it as a supersymmetric theory minus some particles in the supersymmetric theory. You compute the diagrams in the supersymmetric theory using fancy supersymmetric methods. You then subtract the effect of the extra particles you added, and you get the answer in QCD. It's okay? It is magic. I wouldn't be talking about it if it weren't magic. Okay. And by the way, I take no credit for this magic. I'm giving the credit to the people whose names are on these slides. Okay, so at this point, it's possible to automate the calculation of very complicated QCD amplitudes. And so here are some results. There's a collaboration called Black Hat, which is Barron et al. And here are some calculations that those people did. So those are these are now radiative corrections to W production with three jets, three QCD jets in the final state. So this is a four-particle final state. What's plotted here are the distributions for the three invariant masses between the three sets of gluons. What's interesting is this, there's this estimate I gave you, which maybe wasn't the best estimate in the world, for the accuracy of the calculation in terms of the scale dependence. You vary the QCD scale of the calculation, and you see how much difference that makes. At the tree level, the error is given by the hatched band. So at the bottom, I have leading order over next to leading order. The leading order error is given by the hatched band, the error in the next to leading order calculation by the solid band. You can compare these to experimental results from the Tevatron. And actually, here are some comparisons for the ET of the second jet and for the transverse energy of the third jet in relation to data that was taken from CDF. And once again, looking at the bands, you see that the theoretical calculation becomes considerably more accurate, from 40% error to about 10% error, including these, frankly, really hard to get next to leading order corrections. Okay. You might think that you could do just as well if you knew what the scale was. But of course, it's useful to be able to do a computation to tell you the scale. The diagram on the left corresponds to a poor choice of the scale at which to evaluate alpha S of Q. That poor choice, however, had been used almost universally in the literature. And the diagram on the right is a better choice that was motivated by the result of this calculation. Okay. So now we can evaluate tree diagrams. We can evaluate loop diagrams. What's left to do? Well, there's a lot left. And there's one more aspect of this that I wanted to highlight, which is that even at the level of the loop diagrams that we know how to compute now, there are only, let's say, three or four particles in the final state. If we view each of those particles as making an individual jet of hadrons, such as you saw in the examples I showed you at the beginning of the lecture, we're fine. But if you want to know more detailed things about the event, for example, if you want to understand the structure of the jets as well as the number of jets that are emitted, you have to work a little harder. It turns out that when you think about higher orders in QCD, you actually need to understand not only the radiation of one or two gluons, but maybe many gluons, 10, 15, 20. There's an advantage in that that I'd now like to discuss. So if I, for example, start computing, let's go back just to tree amplitudes, some diagram with gluon exchange, gluon emission, I can also consider a diagram where that gluon emits a gluon. And there's some algebra done on this slide, but let me just write the basic formula. There's an alpha S over pi, but now this diagram can be singular in various ways. If the original momentum here is p, and the final gluon takes a momentum zp, there's a singularity in the soft limit, so there's a dz over z. If there's an opening angle here, so some transverse momentum in the system, if that transverse momentum goes to zero, so these two gluons are collinear with each other, then this becomes a system of two collinear massless particles, which is a massless particle. And so as kT goes to zero, this momentum goes on shell, and there's another logarithmic singularity associated with that. And so each diagram like this, and even for each emission, has a double logarithmic enhancement when the gluons either become soft or become the two emitted products become collinear. Now, if you think about this, alpha S over pi is some number which is a 20th or something like that, and then you have the log squared of some q divided by, let's say, a GeV. This number can easily be large enough to compensate that one. And so what happens then is that if you really want to think about the process accurately, you need to have a series of gluon emissions, and you have to sum them all up. So now we're really in the stampede of the gluons. Now, this problem has been understood since the 80s, and there are systematic ways to do it. Essentially, what you do is that you try and consider the region of momentum that gives you a double logarithm at every stage. You can then write an evolution equation of the kind that I've written on this at the bottom of this slide. And then you can write a Monte Carlo program, which essentially turns this evolution equation into a Markov process and generates the final state by splitting off the various gluons. If you don't have complete control over these tree amplitudes, you can't do that exactly. But the big contribution comes when the gluons are either soft or collinear. So then you can take advantage of the fact that there are good approximations in that region, and you use the approximate formulae to split off the gluons. And so in that way, you can compute amplitudes for glu-glu or QQ bar going to 10, 20, 40 gluon final states. And those final states give some kind of description of the momentum flow in the process. They describe not only the gluon making a jet, but they actually describe the internal structure of the jet. And I hope I have an example here. No, this is yet another problem. I'll show you some examples, I think, a little later as we come toward the conclusion. So now, however, you have the following problem. What one really wants to think about for, let's say, searches for supersymmetry are backgrounds that involve a Z, which, let's say, decays to something invisible, and four jets in the system coming out like that. Each of these four jets, the four jets might originate by some process like this that I've just described. But these four gluons here, to be part of the background, should be at large angles. So if I'm only using a small angle approximation to create those gluons, I'm making some error. And somehow I have to make a compromise between my ability to make many gluons, which relies on an approximation, and the fact that I want to know about gluons emitted at large angles, which requires an exact expression. So I think just as an illustration of that, there's a calculation here of the first and second gluons emitted in top quark production at the LHC. The solid line is the result of a Feynman diagram calculation. The error bands shown are the results of these parton shower calculations using the program Pythia with different tunes of Pythia. And as you see, there's large uncertainty there, which you would like to remedy. So there's a technology developed that does this, which is called matrix element parton shower matching. Essentially, what you have to do is to be very intricate about how you define the phase space. So you have, let's say, a 4-gluon, 5-gluon, 10-gluon phase space, and you carve it up in different ways. In one way, you're only going to keep gluons that are emitted by Feynman diagrams. And of course, you can only keep them as to your power to compute the Feynman diagrams. And maybe I should also say to do the phase space integrals over those rather nasty expressions. In the regions of phase space that are more soft and collinear, we'll use the parton shower algorithm. And there are well-developed programs that do that. Pythia and Herwig are two examples. Then what you have to make sure, though, is that you're insensitive to where you put the boundary between these regimes. And then you get a computation of which an example is given here. So here we have a kinematic quantity, essentially the logarithm of some invariant mass of two jets. The region to the left of that boundary is computed with a parton shower. The region to the right of the boundary is computed with explicit matrix elements. The various colored dotted lines are the contributions from matrix elements with 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4 gluon emission. What happens then is, and then each of those will then have a parton shower added to it to make the complete structure of the event. If everything works well, there's a smooth join between the two regions, giving a fairly reliable prediction. Right now, we know how to do this at the tree level, but soon I hope that will also be improved to the one-loop level. So now, there's one more thing that I should really talk about in cataloging the uses of QCD knowledge to do LHC physics. And that is that if you really believe that you understand all this stuff, the ability to find the cross sections for many gluons, to understand the radiation of gluons from gluons, to understand how the radiation from gluons and gluons and gluons and gluons will make the momentum structure of a jet, that is a set of particles that you see in an elementary particle detector, then you can try and go back and ask, can I analyze the jets not only as global quantities, but also look at the jet substructure? And it turns out there are interesting examples of things you can do with that. Let me then just tell you a little about how you would build jets from the other side, the experimental side, and then we'll talk about the use of that. So what I've done on this slide is to represent a typical elementary particle event, which would produce some particles. The particles appear at some angle, which is parametrized here by phi, the azimuthal angle, and eta, the rapidity of the particle, which is a surrogate for the polar angle. And typically, those particles will cluster into jets. The nearby particles will all be the results of a single hard quark or gluon that goes out. And you can define algorithms which essentially at more greater or lower levels of precision, but you can define very precisely what you're doing, algorithms that gather those particles together and form jets and try and reconstruct the things that are essentially at earlier places in the Feynman diagram that were the more fundamental particles. And there's been a huge amount of work on this. Gavin Salam in Paris is probably the world expert on this kind of analysis. Let me skip over how you define these algorithms. But now let me tell you something you can do with them. So, let me show you this slide first. This is the analysis of a particular event shown again in a plot of phi versus eta, with the transverse momentum drawn as towers on this plot. This is called the Lego plot. And the area associated with each jet, so the particles I've gathered together to make a jet. And you can see that using different algorithms, you get a slightly different separation of the particles. But all the really high towers, as you see, correspond to jets that are well-defined between the algorithms. OK, well, now you can take this method and try and do something with it. For example, you can try and figure out what the width is of a jet. Now, that's interesting, because in QCD, gluon-induced jets are wider, in general, than quark-induced jets. It's easier for gluons to radiate gluons, so you get more particles within the jet, and they're spread out more if you start with a gluon rather than a quark. So you could try to think about whether you can discriminate gluons from quarks, figuring out, essentially, how wide the jets are and how many particles there are in them. But there's something even more interesting that you can do, which is to think about whether there can be heavy particles in the jets. So for example, something you might really want to do is find the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson at the LHC, if it's a light Higgs boson of mass, let's say, 120 or 130 GeV, its main decay is into BB bar. It gives two bottom quarks in a jet. And those bottom quarks, of course, can be produced in many other ways. It's a hard signal to see. A process you would really like to look for is QQ bar going to a W or a Z, let's say a Z plus a Higgs. So that's an event that would look like this. You have a Z particle over here decaying to a lepton pair, a Higgs over here decaying to BB bar, and, of course, all the other stuff that happens when the proton is disrupted. Now, there are lots of other background processes. For example, quark-antiquark annihilation radiating a gluon, which can equally well turn into BB bar. And this B and B bar can be at very high mass, and it may be very difficult to distinguish processes like this from processes like that. So Salam and his colleagues suggested the following algorithm to do this. First of all, let's not worry about the general reaction. Let's look at that maybe 10% of all the Higgses that I make, which have very high boosts. Then the Higgs is boosted very far in this direction. And the B and B bar live inside a single cone, like that. Now what I want to do is to analyze the proper, and then this cone will be analyzed by the algorithms I've described as being a single jet. But it's not an ordinary jet, it's an exotic jet, because it contains a heavy particle with a decay at a very large momentum transfer. So what I'd like to do is to figure out which events have exotic jets and which events just have ordinary jets. So to do that, what you do is you build up those jets and then you take them apart, as is shown here. You start with the jet that you've made, and then you try and take it apart into two segments. And then you look at things like, what is the relative amount of energy of the jet in each of the two segments? If it's more or less balanced, that's from a heavy particle decay, most probably. If it's very imbalanced, that's the more typical thing that happens in QCD. So let's use that as a discrimination. The first thing that happens is that very often these jets will contain extra gluons that are split off like that. So if I can remove that gluon by the way that I'm reconstructing the jet, then I get a more accurate determination of the mass of the Higgs boson. I get a sharper peak. And so in their analysis, the peak associated with the Higgs boson, reconstructed as the mass of a jet, will be sharper. But the really important impact of this comes when you have something that's gluons or quarks faking bottom. In this case, the momentum sharing between these two gluons is very imbalanced. And if you just say, well, this is probably not a heavy particle decay, then you can dramatically decrease the background with the same algorithm, as is shown on this slide. And then finally, what you decide is that whereas in the usual methods of analysis, the Higgs was totally invisible, with this better understanding of the detailed substructure of QCD jets, you can find an algorithm that pulls the Higgs boson out above background. And this has actually given a lot of new hope that one can find the Higgs boson maybe even in the first couple years of the LHC, even in this mass region where it's supposed to be very, very difficult to find. There are lots more developments of this business of heavy jets and exotic jets that people are working on now. It's a very active area of research. So maybe it's time to stop. I've told you a lot of things that I hope were interesting to you about old developments and new developments in QCD. It's a very active field right now as people try and invent more and more sophisticated ways to look at the events that are coming out of the LHC. Of course, the goal is to really understand QCD and find new things on top of it that would represent new particles that would really, I guess, shake up our understanding of the basic equations of nature. But nevertheless, the subject has its own beauty and hopefully supplies some good ideas to aid those discoveries. So, thank you very much.
Do we have questions?
Thanks. So the methods for analyzing these things, especially the loop ones with the cuts, look very nice. But my question that comes out of that is that's all one loop. So are higher loops, A, unimportant enough to be neglected, and B, if not, what is the progress on understanding them?
So you're asking now about going beyond one loop.
Yeah.
And I showed you some results on two-loop calculations of the simplest processes, glue to Higgs and Drellier. So there's another set of techniques that you can use, which are more like the old-fashioned conventional techniques, which work well at that level. I think no one knows how to understand how to extend those calculations to three loops. There's a major program in Zurich to evaluate the top quark production cross-section. So that's glue to TT bar. It's a 2-to-2 process at the next deleting order, using things that look more like the older methods before these unitarity-based methods. And that seems to be feasible. It's a huge effort. It's a multi-year effort by a large team. And I guess Thomas Germann is the head of that effort. We hope that they will show some results soon. The use of these unitarity-based methods for two-loop calculations is still, it's very unclear how to do it. There are some things that you can do in very highly supersymmetric theories. So I think the idea is you'll start with the most supersymmetric theories and then try and work your way down. So Baron, Dixon, and collaborators have presented some two-loop and I think even three-loop amplitudes in N equals 4 Super-Young-Mills theory. So there you take advantage of all the symmetries of the theory basically to gather numerator factors, make the integrals as simple as possible. One can make some progress in that way. The vision then is that you would calculate real QCD amplitudes by doing the things I was explaining to John here, namely to start with the most supersymmetric case and then subtract the fictitious particles out. But that just hasn't been worked out systematically how you do that. The level of accuracy maybe is worth discussing. The error of a one-loop calculation for the kind of things I've been talking about is 40%. The error of a tree-level calculation is 40%. The error of a one-loop calculation, one expects, is about 10%. If you want to get to the percent level, as one certainly does for the top quark cross-section, you have to go at least to two loops. And, we'll see. People have to become more clever and invent more beautiful tricks. And this process will go on for some time. Well, it, you know, again, it depends on the level of accuracy you want to achieve. But yeah, if you want to get to the 1% level, you need the next to next to leading order. Oh, no, no, no. I think for new particle discovery, the 10% level is adequate, unless the supersymmetric particles or whatever are multi-TeV, in which case we're really going to have to worry. For maybe 1 TeV particles, I think people believe that the 10% level of accuracy is adequate. And there are other tricks you can use. I skipped over this slide. But let me go back to it, because maybe it's very relevant to this question. If you're interested in jets plus missing energy, one of the backgrounds to jets plus missing energy is producing a Z0 plus jets and having the Z0 decay to neutrinos. But that calculation, we don't need to do the calculation. We can actually evaluate that from data. Because the Z also decays to muon pairs, for example. There are muon pairs, the kinematics of Z to muon pairs is exactly the same as the kinematics of the Z decay to neutrinos. So what you would do is measure the process of Z decay to muon pairs, and then the contribution of the Z decay to neutrinos is 6 times larger, and it has exactly the same kinematic features. Okay, well, there's a problem with that. It means that you can only get 1/6 as far in terms of your data sample. So now you have to do an exercise like the one I've shown on this slide. On the left, we have a curve which is really justified from data. I mean, that's really what you want. It includes not only all of QCD, but includes your detector response, all the experimental uncertainties, everything you would want to know, as well as you can construct the Z to mu plus mu minus cross-section with multi-jets, you can make that curve. However, at a certain point, you run out of steam in terms of your ability to predict that curve. So if, indeed, you're just supposed to take the lowest order QCD answer and multiply by a K factor, it's fine. But if the QCD corrections depend on kinematics, we don't know whether the right curve is the red line that I drew or something that goes in that band. And if the data follows the red line, we have to ask, can we really say that's a discovery? So this is another strategy which maybe means that you don't have to work quite so hard in terms of the absolute accuracy of a QCD calculation. But you have to understand the systematic dependence on kinematics extremely well. So eventually what people do is put all these things together. You have some absolute calculations. You have some extrapolations based on experimental data. Those extrapolations have uncertainty, which is related to your understanding of the dependence of corrections on kinematics. Multiple approaches have to say that the data is in excess of these backgrounds in order to claim a signal. And we'll see. Hopefully we'll get there.
The compact muon solenoid group, CMS, LHC, claim now this month that they've excluded gaichinos and squawks up to 500 or 600 GeV. And the reason they can do it, they claim, is because in the CMS, the kinematics of the QCD background is such that the you're looking for the missing transverse energy, and it lies in the plane of the experiment. So at a certain cut, the amount of QCT is significantly reduced down to the standard model particles. This is their claim as of now.
Yes.
So if they use this technique, it is possible to exclude the QC background significantly.
Well,
you show graphs doing this.
Well, so they've published a very beautiful result, but let me qualify it just a little. In principle, you could make a plot. For example, in a supersymmetric model, there's a gluino mass, and there's a mass of the lightest supersymmetric particle. And then, in principle, we could live anywhere on this plane. If we believe that the lightest supersymmetric particle is lighter than the gluino, we live in half of the plane, this region down here. Now, in this plane, there's a specific class of models called constrained minimal supersymmetry, the constrained MSSM or M-Sugra. These models have the property that the gluino mass is roughly equal to 7 times the mass of the lightest supersymmetric particle. So they live on a particular line here. In these models, there are some specific reactions that rely on this big energy difference. So in particular, if there's this big energy difference and you have a two-body final state, there are very specific things you can say. So along this line, the Tevatron has an exclusion out to about 400 GeV, and CMS has just extended that out to about 600 GeV. It's known what this Tevatron limit looks like in the rest of the plane. It bends back like that in some funny way. So the real limit on the gluino along this line is maybe 100 GeV. And what the LHC has done is to carve out another little region here. So this year, I hope, we're going to get to something that looks like this, which is very robust limits of order 800 GeV in these parameters. But you've just seen the first bite of it now, and only in two jet final states. So we'll see what the rest of the data looks like this year.
Oh, just a quick comment that Gordon Kane predicted in 1997 that if the breaking of supersymmetry is around the electroweak scale, say 1 TeV, then we would see now supersymmetric particles around 500 GeV. Apparently, we're not seeing that.
Well, Gordy Kane is the ultimate supersymmetry optimist. So if Gordy Kane's predictions are not verified, okay, supersymmetry suffers a loss, but it doesn't mean we should give up. I think you give up when you get to about 2 TeV or something like that. Then you've really killed off the sweet spot of where supersymmetry should be to be connected to the hierarchy problem. Now, maybe I should just say, there are lots of other explanations of the hierarchy problem, all of which predict new particle spectroscopy in this general mass range. So if we find something, it might not be supersymmetry. But if we find nothing, the hierarchy problem really becomes much, much more difficult. And you know, we really need an intensive search for new particles in this region that might actually explain where the Higgs symmetry breaking comes from, where the hierarchy comes from. I guess I'm personally am much more confident that we will find something there than that we will find supersymmetry. But okay, maybe there's nothing. Then you need another way of explaining where the Higgs mass comes from.
Okay, well, let's leave it there. And thank Michael again for a great talk.
Okay. Okay. Sorry that this was a...